What's that? We're back. We're going to discuss Parashat Vayikra. I was actually toying with saying, let's not do Vayikra, let's just do Megillat Esther, but that would be cheating, because the problem... What? It would be totally cheating, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to tackle Vayikra. What? Oh. No, which is the problem, which is exactly why I wanted to tackle Vayikra, because... on the one hand, it is the entirety of Vayikra and Tzav deal with Korbanot, right? Ritual sacrifice, and we're going to talk about which ritual sacrifice. And it's very detail oriented. So you said you're going to have to do Vayaka Pakude. Those are your boys' parshiot next year. Good luck. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I skipped. We missed.
Two parshiot.
So that's two parshiot.
Oh. How is that possible? Oh, it's a double. So they're going to split it.
Parsha.
Good for them. Okay.
No, works out well.
Yeah, it does work out well.
No, I always, every year in America, I remember Tzidi would call me in before, like, at this time, like in April time, for his office, I would always have this panic attack that he was going to tell me I had to teach Vayikra next year.
Just so you know, there's a midrash that says the following. Amar Rab Asi, Mibnei ma matchilim letinokot b'torat kehanim. Why do we begin teaching children with Vayikra? Torat kehanim is the midrashic term for Vayikra. Ve'ein matchilim b'breishit. We don't start with breishit. What? Tinokot tahorim, the children are tahor, they're pure, but korbanot tahorim. And the korbanot are pure. Yavog tahorim, vidasku b'tahorim. So there's a tradition from the times of Chazal that the first thing the child learns is not Rishi. The first thing the child learns is Sefer Vayikra. And then they go back and they learn whatever. And
that?
Excellent question. And I'm pretty sure that many Haredi schools do it. They do Vayikra.
They do.
I remember,
they would always say Vayikra
for the older grades.
Really? I learned Vayikra.
I learned Parshat Kedoshim in eighth grade.
Correct.
That was my extensive.
You skip it. You know when I learned Vayikra? We didn't learn Vayikra. It's all skipped. It's because. And the reason is there's a very simple reason why we skip Vayikra. What is the reason?
Nobody knows how to teach it.
It's boring. Right,
Nobody knows how to teach it.
Ah, right. So today you're going to learn exciting Vayikra. That's really the reason I wanted to not skip it, because these are things that actually boys, sometimes I'm learning with my son, we learn Mishnah Yomit. So if you hit the Mishnah Yomit, then you actually have just some rudimentary knowledge of this Korbanot. If you've never hit it, you probably have never heard of these things or what they're, you know what I mean? You've heard of the Korbanot, but you don't understand what you're supposed to do. So I thought today we'd read the text. You know, call me crazy, okay, and go through some of the details and obviously some of the relevant Rashis as well, which we'll point out. Sound good?
Can we tackle one day, like the basics of Korbanot, like why?
We never did that. I thought we had done that at some point. We never did that. Why Korbanot in general? Like that.
Is it not like I think of it as an old thing that you know we only did because.
Yes, because.
Because that's what the Goyim did, and we wanted to feel like we had a show also.
Where do you get that from? Who told you that?
Yeah, they're
back. Are you sure we haven't done that? Have we ever discussed this before? Doesn't sound like it's something we've discussed.
Right.
So that actually... The reason... I think we moved from Wednesday to Tuesday or something. Okay, the reason for Korbanot is a huge topic. And people want to, are you that right? W-O-N-T? People quote the Rambam very often. The Rambam in?
That's old.
Do you know where? Moreh Nevuchim. Okay? So the Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim exactly what Miriam just said, that the reason for the Korbanot, or one of the rationales behind the Korbanot, was because people lived in a pagan society and that they were accustomed to worshipping idolatry. And for that reason, and so therefore, in order to wean them and to sort of elevate what they were accustomed to, so therefore the Torah commanded that we would have to offer korbanot in a similar way. Hold on 1 second. Okay. Let's see if I can find it. The Ramban quotes the Rambam. He quotes him this commentary of the Rambam. Okay. And then say, and then comes out very, very strongly against it. I'll see if I can find it in the
shocker.
Ramban himself. What?
A shocker.
Do you know where it is in the Ramban? Can you find it? You have no idea?
You never touched
Vayikra. Okay, I actually read it. I read it in this book, in Rav Nachshoni's book. Rav Nachshoni's book, it's very good. He quotes a bunch of, this is the topic that bothers people. There's only one problem with the Rambam saying that. Okay? If the Rambam really believed that the reason for a korbanot was only to wean us off of idolatry, it's too much. It doesn't make any sense. If you think about how much volume korbanot get in the literature of the Torah, it's a ton. Moreover, the Rambam wrote two books. One book he wrote was a book of philosophy called Myrna Buchim. The other major work that he also wrote, he really wrote three. One was a commentary in the Mishnah. He wrote the Myrna Buchim, The Guide to the Perplexed. And what was the third thing that he wrote?
He wrote the Mishnah Torah.
Okay? The Rambam was unique in that his Mishnah Torah was all-encompassing. As opposed to Shulchan Aruch that came much, much later. Shulchan Aruch was like, you know, we can't really deal with everything now. We're just going to write the things that are relevant. Rambam says, no, I want Mishnah Torah. I want the whole Torah. And he dedicates at least two, probably three of the books of the Yad HaChazakah, of the 14, to the Beit HaMikdash, the Korbanot, Seder Avodah. This is part and parcel of what the Rambam understands Judaism, normative Judaism, to be. And it would have been very easy to say, this is what they did back then, and when Mashiach comes, we'll try to figure it out. But it's major. It's really a major element of the Yad HaChazakah. So it's difficult to say. The Rambam himself thought that these were just some kind of a concession to idolatry. In his times, people weren't worshipping Korbanot. Right?
Well,
I find it difficult to, you know, to think. I know where the Rambam said it, and people say that the Rambam said it in Myrna Buchim, because it's in a book of philosophy. Shulchan Aruch skips it.
No, but the Mishnah Torah doesn't skip anything.
You say. Right.
So why would he skip
it? Yeah, but the question is, I mean, that's a question of skip it. It's a methodologically, if you thought the whole thing was a concession to idolatry, do you think that we're not idolaters today? Is it an ideal, or is it something that's...
It's a chumash. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But
you're not getting to the heart of the question. You're not getting to the heart of Miriam's question.
It?
What?
How could he not address it? It's made.
How about we say Shabbat's not really relevant to either. You know,
exactly.
They needed those rest days back then, but, you know.
What's not relevant?
Shabbat. Kashrut.
Shabbat's more relevant now than ever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
there is
no bit of
Midrash
now.
But what you're saying is that
we
can't say that things have inspired it.
Yeah,
I disagree on your I categorically disagree with you
on
your
I'm listening. On my characterization of the Rambam,
like so flabbergasted actually. Yes, I don't think that it's that the Shulchan Aruch left it out and an issue of relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more significant given that of all of the Sifrei Halakha that were written, the Rambam is the only one, I believe, who does include it.
Yes.
So it's not that
but it's all-encompassing.
That's
correct.
It's not only all-encompassing. The Rambam's credo was Mashiach is coming. Mashiach is here. We have to be ready for it. Exactly. And so it's a crucial, essential part of his halacha work. It's not that other people left it out.
No, but I'm saying, I agree with you, but if you really thought...
It's not an issue of relevance or not.
Really
the Beit HaMikdash is not here now. So that's your definition of relevance. It's not that we can't connect to it or we don't need it or anything like that. The Beit HaMikdash is not here now. So it's not immediately something that we need to deal with.
Even in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, when the Beit HaMikdash will come back, will it be relevant?
So I think the Shulchan Aruch would think that the Beit HaMikdash is
of course
the
he would.
Is here that the Korbanot are relevant.
Agreed. Of course I agree.
Rambam would have said the Rambam.
With the Rambam.
Of course he would. Why would you say that it's not relevant?
If you thought.
If it now, without a Beit HaMikdash, he felt the need to include it in his Sefer Halakha, why would you assume then in the time of the Beit HaMikdash that we won't need it?
Because he gave the basis for it as being channeling of idolatrous passions that we don't have anymore.
But we spent the whole thing, half of the Mishkan is like that. Also, the whole, like, taking negative tendencies and channeling them in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's what life is about.
Yeah, but if we don't have that tithe anymore.
But we do, it's just a different thing. Oh, of course
that's we do. This is the question. The question is, the essential question is, we have difficulty associating with this whole concept of korbanot.
The animal.
That's our question. Our question is, how, you know, we externalize it for the Rambam. We talk about the making of machloket Rambam. But what? Right, correct. What bothers us really is reading Parshat Vayikra, and you slaughter the animal and you spray the blood, which we'll get into. And like, and it just totally what? Gross.
Why is it gross?
Why is it this? Oh,
it's. Didn't they tell them to take out their tithe? The thing is a different.
No, taiva for avodah zarah. Yes, you're quoting the Gemara that says that they daven to remove the taiva for avodah zarah, for idolatry. First of all, I talk to my friends who travel to India all the time. They say it absolutely does exist.
Can I just say that Johnny's in India?
Yeah, there's idolatry all the time. He says
he arrived at work with another carpet of flowers, and then they asked him to light candles.
Oh,
a welcoming ceremony. He said, thank you so much, but rather let my boss do it tomorrow.
See, that's the beauty of Johnny. He's so tactful.
I'm so honored. I think it's more appropriate.
It's, the candles are...
It's pure idolatry. Pure
idolatry.
It's a ceremony.
Sure.
And then they've got the bindi, or they mark you with the thing on your forehead and everything.
Yeah, the idolatry does exist today. It just doesn't exist in the Western world. That's A. I don't know if they do animal sacrifice. They probably do. I bet you they do. But they don't tell you about it.
If the cow's in the middle of the road, then you can't drive.
Well,
you can't touch the cow and you can't move the cow. So you just have to stay where you are.
Is that how it is? They have to wait for the cow?
They have special ambulances. In case something happens to a cow, they have special ambulances that will come and
collect the cow.
Uh-huh.
So anyway,
they worship the cow.
Yesterday was Rosh Chodesh. So what did we say? We said Mizbeach Chadash B'Tzion Tachin. We said this in Rosh Chodesh in Musaf. We prayed this yesterday. Please bring a new altar in Tzion. Ve'olat Rosh Chodesh Na'ale Alav, and we shall offer the Korban Ola of Rosh Chodesh. U'Si'irei Izim Na'aseh V'Ratzon, and we will offer, bring the offering of the Si'irei Izim, the Si'irim, the goats. Uba Abodat Beit Mikdash Nismach Kulanu, and we will all rejoice in the service of the Beit HaMikdash. B'Shirei David Avdecha, Amimi B'Mizbechecha. Okay. B'Havyeinu L'Tzion Ircha B'Rina, and you should bring us to Tzion, your city, with glee, Rina, joy. L'Yerushalayim Beit Mikdash B'Simchat Olam. V'Sham Na'aseh L'Fanecha Et Korbanot Chovoteinu. There we will bring the korbanot of our obligation to midim kisidram umustafim kehilchatam. Just so you understand, every tefillat musaf we say, you're basically praying for one thing. Please, God, bring back the Beit HaMikdash so that we can offer the korbanot. Right? And I think that, sadly, if most people were aware of the fact that we were actually, this is what we were asking for, they would have trouble with it. Really? You know what I'm saying? Because when we come to Vayikra, we get the honest answer that this kind of grosses me out. That's what I'm praying for? That's really what I want? Do we really want the korbanot? So if you say that it's all some concession to idolatry, it's very difficult to say, well, I want this concession to idolatry that I don't have the desire for to be turned, because this is the end-all and be-all of Jewish existence. This is the Beit HaMikdash that we want. Right? So the answer, it's got to be something more than that. That's why I personally think that, you know, I have trouble saying that the Rambam's theory is normative, even to the Rambam. I don't believe that he thought that. I think that was one way of answering a certain question. It was one, you know, you answer questions for different people in different ways. So, you know, philosophical, it was very, you know, Mor Nevuchim I have never studied, but to understand of it, it's a very logical, reasonable, it's a logical argument. How do we explain the mitzvot in logical ways? So if you want to explain the korbanot in logical, reasonable ways, then you have to give a logical understanding and explanation that someone else is going to understand. Okay, so what's it going to be? They were worshiping idols, and now they no longer worship idols. But that's not it. Do we really believe that all of Judaism is only about that which we can logically understand? Yes. Hope not. Of course not. There's much, much more to it.
So much of the mm-hmm.
Correct. All of it is chok, per se. We don't really understand necessarily. I mean, we can try to come to understanding of
you
it.
Understand.
on any level.
To do it, to actually picture yourself doing it. Not that they want to.
Okay, let's start. Then what do we do? Let's talk about, first of all, what happens.
And to want.
Let's gross you out, and then we'll talk about, we'll gross you out.
No, but in the olden days also, when you wanted to eat a chicken, you also had to take the chicken to the shofar.
Right.
And you had to wrap it up, and you had to come home and clean it. So it's very similar, I think. To
correct.
Exactly so similar.
What?
So similar.
It's absolutely similar. Why?
Why? If you wanted a piece
of... I'm going to give you my blood spiel. I'm going to give you my blood spiel. I'm sure I've given this spiel before, but I'm happy to do it again. We live in an antiseptic society in which we prefer to immunize ourselves and separate ourselves from the concept of anything that has to do with blood. So if you look at how do we execute people?
Injection.
And lethal injection, because we don't want to see any blood, right? Even when we kill people, we kill them bloodlessly. We want to eat animals. We like eating animals. Anybody here vegetarian? None of us. All of us eat animals. When's the last time any of you saw a slaughtering of an animal? Have you ever seen, anybody here has ever seen shechita?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I were to see shechita, I'd be vegetarian.
No, you wouldn't. So that troubles me, because I believe then that maybe you should be a vegetarian. Because what are you saying?
I could be close to vegetarian.
Essentially, what are you saying? A statement like that, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, so you can tell me if I am. A statement like that saying, if I were to see a shechita, I would be a vegetarian, is saying what?
No, I know what
you're
saying.
What?
It's saying you're an ostrich. You're putting your head in the sand.
Yeah, no, I know what I'm doing. Yeah.
You're squeamish and queasy. Ah, a couple times, you would get over it. You would. Because what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're squeamish and queasy about blood tests.
But you do it. I'm not attacking her per se, but what I'm trying to say is that we have no problem with the killing of animals. We are very happy to have animals killed. Nobody thinks that when I go buy the undercut in the grocery store that it was grown in a lab. We're very comfortable having animals being killed on our behalf. There's only one thing we don't want. We don't want to see it. We don't want to know about it. And we don't even want to think about where it came from. We don't even nowadays associate the meat that we eat, the chicken that we ate, with an actual chicken. Right? It doesn't, I mean, unless you actually buy the whole chickens and you have to cut it up and all that. It doesn't even look like a chicken. It looks like, you know what I'm saying? You know, ask the average, what? What's that?
I remember when we were walking, my aunt's talking about, and we were walking through the shopping district, and there's all these like chickens hanging.
I'm sorry, real chickens.
Real chickens, like half placketed.
But ask yourself, what does that say about us as a society, that we on the one hand have a desire to eat the flesh of animals, but on the other hand somehow console ourselves by convincing ourselves that it's a bloodless, violentless act? That's exactly what we do. And there's an unbelievable level of hypocrisy involved in that, if we think about it. Okay, so and what I also like to tell people, and I think is absolutely true, we have no problem killing animals for ourselves. But if you bring up the idea of killing an animal for God, well, that's a waste, and how can you do it, and it's so terrible, etc., etc. Moreover, we've even removed the idea of blood from the equation, because when you're a grandmother, when she bought the chicken, so there were three processes, right? First process was your grandmother took the chicken to the shochet. The shochet shechted the chicken and gave it back to her. And then she had to pluck it and gut it and all that kind of fun stuff. Right? Correct. But that might have been your great-grandmother.
I remember my grandmother.
No. My mother used to do that.
Your mother did that? Step two.
My grandmother.
Yeah. Step two. What was step two? Step two was you didn't shecht it anymore. You didn't have to do that. But what did you have to do? You had to salt it. That was step two. They shechted it for you. They plucked it for you. But that was it. And yet, within a certain amount of time, and all of our, I think my mother, at some point, still had the bin and the colander.
And let me tell you, to shecht that you need to be very strong.
What, a chicken?
To shecht any, like a
chicken?
A cow.
A cow, yeah. No.
It's very hard work.
Well, whatever.
Just what is the...
Like, why? Because you have to remove the blood. The salting is the removal of the blood.
What is a better thing? To be a vegetarian? To eat it and not think about blood.
Why not number three? Eat it and understand what you're eating. And I think that there's a level of lack of appreciation we have and connection to nature. And I'll explain to you what the cost is. Okay? I think there's a tremendous cost. Our society... Avodah Zarah, 100 years of Avodah Zarah, why do you say that?
Because maybe initially our association of eating the blood and the sprinkling wasn't a negative association, but it's become associated with cruelty and killing animals for pleasure and...
Through idolatry? You think because of idolatry it's become that way? It's only become that way in the last century by maximum. Well, not maximum. People didn't have a problem slaughtering animals for food. That's how you ate. They had to live. Only, it's fascinating, in the era of industrialization, when we commoditized animals, on the one hand we commoditized them.
Commoditized?
Yes, make them a commodity.
It's not a word.
Is that a word? Excuse me, you're an English professor. It's not? Commoditized. We make them a commodity. We transform them into something that you don't grow on your farm, but something grow far away from you. That's industrialized, that's separate and distant from you. And only then do we say, on the same time, that the animals are so special that I don't want to know that they're being killed. It's very fascinating that there's a problem. We disassociate ourselves with blood. Until that point, you lived on the farm, or you lived in a rural village. It was normal. The animals were around you, and you had to eat. And this was part of life. It was part of the cycle of life. And more importantly, it was very expensive to slaughter animals. So you didn't do it all the time. It wasn't like you had chicken every day. So there's a... Is it a word? Commoditize? It is a word.
I think better is commodify.
Commodify. Okay. Anyway, so we learned something. Okay, so on the one hand, we have more meat than we ever did, and it's considered more immoral than it ever was to slaughter animals, but we do it all the time. We're living in this incredible paradox. Right. At the same time, society... Especially Western society, and the more Western and quote-unquote advanced you are, the more bloodthirsty society is. And you see this in television, media, video games, and sports. Right? Society is consumed with violence. Right? There is no successful film that doesn't have either sex, of course, or violence. Why?
Or it's aimed at the woman.
Right, if it's not... That was A, not B. Okay, why? You get a rush out of it. You get a thrill out of it. Do you know how much money companies make billions in the B of dollars by selling video games that are called first-person shooter video games? What's first-person shooter games? You're the shooter, and you go around shooting and killing things. Billions of dollars. Why is that appealing to people? It goes to the fact. What's that?
I mean, I think it's a sense of being in control. If I'm looking at kids are not being bloodthirsty. But it's a way for them to feel that they're mastering their world.
You could let them master their world. I promise you, there are hundreds of video games out there. Hundreds that allow you to master and create beautiful things and wonderful worlds and do puzzles. Except somehow they gravitate towards, I want to kill things.
Do you think that if you introduce...
What? Boys. Boys. Mostly boys.
If you introduce these first shooter games in, say, countries like Afghanistan or Pakistan or...
Let me ask you a question. Why is there a phenomenon of incredible gun violence and murder in the United States, and we don't see it here? Why don't we see it here? Thank God. Yet.
Leanna.
Well,
here,
why?
Everybody has a gun.
That's right. Because we know, because we see it firsthand.
Everybody has a gun in America, too.
No, they don't. No, they don't. They don't. It's not out there. The specter of violence here, of attack, of blood, is much more real here. And you walk around there, it's a remote thing. It's not, so people fantasize about it. That's exactly my point. I believe that the human condition, there's a certain, in our humanity, there's a certain violence or thirst or bloodlust, you could say, in all of us.
Like the Hunger Games.
I'm just thinking the hunting, the illegal hunting that goes on, the rhino,
yeah,
whatever. You see these people standing there under this line that kills.
Right, it's as if it's a big deal to shoot a lion from like 1,000 miles away with a scope. Like, you know, you're a strong guy. If you do it with a knife, that would be impressive. You know what I'm saying? Right. You understand what I'm saying? This exists. And so one could possibly suggest that this being, this existing, the Torah takes this innate human quality or condition and asks us to channel it in a way that sanctifies it. Because if you don't, it can go either to Avodah Zarah. Why would you sacrifice animals to Avodah Zarah? Because it's the idea of taking this bloodthirst and using it for pagan purposes. So it's not that, oh, they did it, so therefore we're going to do it another way. They did it because it channeled some, usually idolatry was channeling some physical human desire. Idolatry was often very base. It wasn't just the worship. Do you think of worship in a different way than we normally think? We don't, like, don't think of davening in a shul. Right, very often pagan ritual involved sexuality, it involved eating, it involved defecation, it involved the most base physical attributes of humanity. Why? Because it took these physical attributes and said we have to use it in the worship of our gods. So it's not saying that we're emulating idolatry per se, but it's saying take some base human nature and elevate it, exalt it, make it something unique and something higher. And if you think about it in that way, right, you think about animal sacrifices being gross. It's not animal sacrifices gross. We don't have anything to do with animals. Go on a farm. We're grossed out the same way. Go to a slaughterhouse. It would gross you the same way. Because what that means is we have separated ourselves in some way from this inert, innate, essential element of humanity. And there are costs to that. To sterilize ourselves and sterilize, you know what I'm saying? And we pay the cost. It manifests itself in other ways in society. And we're out of balance, we're out of whack. And I think the korbanot are there for that exact reason. We're missing something in our spiritual output by saying we only do it in this way, you can only worship in this way. Think about it, what is the avenue? We have no physical avenue to exhibit or express our worship. What act do we do in order to worship God? Maybe bow down, maybe? Okay, very good. Wave a little of an intro. What else? It's not worship. That's a mitzvah.
Lighting Shabbos candles.
That's not worship. It's a mitzvah. Yeah. It's very nice. It's a mitzvah, but it's not worship.
It's a difference between worship and mitzvah.
Davening, meaning we have taken the idea of worship out of the physical realm, made it only emotional.
What's the difference between worship and a mitzvah? The whole purpose of the mitzvah is for worship.
No. Those are different things. God commanded you to do X, Y, Z. That's not necessarily
part
of
worship of Him.
Let's look at what happened with both Beit El Mikdash, and we see that the Korbanot, despite the fact that we have this amazing
channel
mm-hmm. Beit El Mikdash and the Shechina, look what happened.
What happens?
In the second Beit El Mikdash, and the worst kind of Averot in the first Beit El Mikdash.
In the times of the Beit El Mikdash.
Yeah, but it was the people that were involved. They were involved.
In behave, I don't understand what you're saying.
No.
Connected to the korbanot,
you take your argument to a logical end. You would say, if we're channeling all this violent energy into korbanot, mm-hmm. then you would think that those times would be ideal, and that the people would have challenged all their negative energies, and there wouldn't be sinat chinam, and there wouldn't be giluyei ariyot, and there wouldn't be shpichut damim. What were those things doing there?
I don't know if that's fair to say. Well, if society would be perfect, there isn't sin. I never suggested. You're suggesting that.
Why would there be shpichut damim if you have this channel for your violence?
A. Not everybody's offering korbanot in the way they're supposed to. The korbanot, the what happened?
What the neviim
also decried was that the korbanot. What the neviim talk about is. The korbanot became like so many other of our mitzvot. We tended to focus on the ritualistic elements of the korban and not the ideal elements of the korban. You're shomer Shabbat, but you know what I'm saying, in letter but not in spirit.
And also, the Beit HaMikdash also.
What do you want? I don't know what to tell you. I'm talking about the idea of korbanot in general. This mitzvah.
I don't know if it worked. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if it worked then. I certainly don't think it will work in the future. But that's just me.
Okay.
Don't report me to.
I would be submitting your name on the chief rabbinate website.
Yeah,
what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
you going
to
say?
No, I was going to suggest that in the times of debate, that perhaps the times of the program could be revisited, because the centralization of the, if I can present such heretical
phrase. Yeah.
Listen.
I'm listening.
Okay, the centralization of the worship, when you have the korbanot only in the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, it removes it from the people who are living in the Tzafon, who are living in the, you know, who are living, who are not, only people who the korbanot affects regularly really are the Kohanim themselves.
One second, you have to make a pilgrimage three times a year.
Three times a year.
Okay, that's a very special event to go three times a year to make a pilgrimage. I think a lot of people did, at least once a year.
Elkanah
had to offer Korban Pesach. Had to offer Korban Pesach.
To the Mishkan. This is the Mishkan event.
Yeah.
He had to convince people to come with him.
Don't joke. You think these things are stunned? You think these things are stunned? These things, the HaKadosh Baruch Hu in natural means is preparing for the Biyat HaMashiach.
I know.
We need that train, that tunnel, that train, the high-speed train.
Online booking. What? Online booking.
Online booking. Are you kidding? 100%.
What?
What, you think that's a joke? That you obviously you're gonna go to the Beit HaMikdash website and get a number and get a time and you're gonna 100%. Why not? These things are great.
You still have to wait for 4 hours once you get there.
What? You probably will have to wait for 4 hours. Although the Mishnah talks about what the Mishnah, the Korban Pesach, the Mishnah Pesachim talks about how actually they were so organized they had three shifts and they said that the third shift was never full because they had gotten everybody done. Apparently the Kohanim they geared up. They say that millions of people came.
Laugh at the cheese counter.
Laugh at the cheese counter. There's numbers at the cheese counter now?
Wherever you go.
What?
Take a number.
Welcome. That's Baruch Hashem. That's Chus Laaretz. Because until us Chusikim came, there were no numbers. It was just. That's right. So, what I want to say, Mina, is he said, if it will be. It will be. Mina said it in a way like if, like you said it in a sort of like if it will come to fruition or something, like if there are korbanot. I don't remember exactly how you said it, but it could. Right. This is what we pray for. This is what we believe will happen. We pray every tefillah, every Shmona Esrei, you pray for korbanot. Every korban, every tefillat musaf, every single one. That's all you're praying for. You're davening for the return of the Beit HaMikdash and the reinstitution of the korbanot. So Chazal clearly felt that not only this was important, they felt this was essential and central to our existence as a people. And so, if we have a disconnect, so we always have a choice. We can say, I'm disconnected from this, and, you know, it's hard for me to appreciate, and it seems esoteric and ancient and gross. Or on the other hand, we can say, we have to try to realign and reassess and try to come to a place where, if they thought it was really good and important, and clearly, you know, we have a whole book of Vayikra that clearly seems to imply, you know, in the book of the Rambam, how do I come to a place where I see this thing as being significant and important? Which is sometimes very difficult because the lives that we lead are so foreign and so alien to remove from the issue the idea of animal sacrifice. It just seems so gross, you know. I'll explain. Let's just read a little bit of Chumash because it's important. Even though this discussion is useful, we should read a little bit in the Chumash. And I'm skipping the fun Rashi's. Vayikra al Moshe, Vayidaber Hashem el Ol Moed. God calls to Moshe from the Ol Moed. There's a whole shiur on that. Next year we'll do that. Daber al Bnei Yisrael b'Ramat Aleihem. Speak to children and say, Adam, ki yakriv mikem korban l'Hashem. Min ha-behema, min ha-bakar, min ha-tzon, takriv et korbanchem. When you should yakriv, the idea of a korban, actually the word korban is a fascinating word in and of itself. Right? L'hakriv korban. That's lehikarev, to become closer. That's right, absolutely correct. Lahakriv korban. It's from the word, from the root of karov, lehikarev. Like korban is the offering, and we translate it as an offering. That's not an accurate translation. A sacrifice. It's not an accurate translation. How would we translate that word? A person is kiyakriv mikem korban. Anybody want to take a stab at it to translate in a way that actually reflects the meaning? You will, right?
Make close
from you a closeness. It's very fair. It doesn't translate.
I don't know that it's... I know sometimes you can have the same shoresh, but it means two different...
It means a sacrifice.
Right.
What?
Right. Correct. Google. Meaning, what does that tell you? Google would do such a... would massacre it. What does that tell you? That the very concept in our lexicon to offer a sacrifice... When I offer a sacrifice, I'm giving up my... I'm like... The word sacrifice, by the way, it itself isn't a good translation of
just
sacrifice.
Just skip that one.
What?
Don't use that one.
What word do you use? That's a... What?
Offering.
Right. Meaning... Do you understand what I'm saying? Meaning in our... there isn't even a term that we can think of that would translate to... We know what it means, ki yakrid mikem korban. But it doesn't... In our English language, it doesn't reflect the emotional or the spiritual response that we wanted to reflect. So, you understand what I'm saying? That's how distant it is, that there isn't even a word for it.
So what do you do when you sacrifice and you're giving something of yourself over to somebody, and by doing that, you're
bring
yourself closer to that person.
Okay.
But it's like share, or that whatever. So that's what sacrifice is. It is a coming closer.
It's
giving of myself to whatever I'm sacrificing to.
Okay. Okay.
Yep, but
correct. My point, though, is the word sacrifice doesn't reflect that closeness. The word ki yakriv korban, in two words, you've said a whole... No, when I say you have to say, you have to make a sacrifice. Does that sound good or sound bad? Yeah, it sounds... When you sacrifice something, you're in English, think about the language, to sacrifice, to make a sacrifice is a negative thing.
You're losing something of yourself.
Correct.
By the giving.
Correct.
So sacrifice and sacred, of course, have the same letter.
Ooh, sacrifice. Okay.
And what? Sacred?
And the person made that up.
Did you make that up?
No.
Oh, okay. Sounds good, right. From the Latin sacrificio. I mean...
What? Sacrilegious.
Okay.
We just have to see what that Latin word is.
Correct. Agreed in the etymology. Anyway, min ha-be'ima min ha-tzon takrivu et korbanchem. Again, lakriv korban. We should maybe not even translate it. Lakriv korban. What? From you, okay? When a person wants to offer. Im ola korbano. What's an ola? Ola?
Korban.
What's an ola? How do we translate ola? Wait, how do they translate it? If it is a...
offering.
They don't translate it. That's interesting. Well, how do you translate it? How's yours?
Offering. If his offering be a burnt
offering. A burnt offering. An ola is a burnt offering. Why? The korban ola,
the whole thing
is offered on the Mizbeach. Most korbanot. Right? Most korbanot. If they weren't an ola offering, what was it? Were you right?
Yeah, yeah. It comes from the Latin something to make sacred, to sanctify.
Okay, good. So, interestingly, what have we done with the word sacrifice? In its original form, it was exactly what it was supposed to be, a korban. We've taken it and we turned it into something negative. If you think about the connotation, you're going to have to make a sacrifice. And somebody, it has an immediate negative that it may be positive in the end. You know, that's interesting. Whereas in the Torah's vernacular, it's totally positive. Like, you korban. Okay? Ola is a burnt offering. It's translated normally as a burnt offering. Why? Because it's all brought on the Mizbeach. The whole thing is burnt on the Mizbeach. But what does ola mean, really?
Ola.
Im ola korbano. If it's korban ola, it rises to God.
If it goes up.
Okay? If it goes up.
Rises.
What?
The smoke rises.
Something rises. But...
Oh, with the smoke, don't the ashes go up and all the...
The korban is an ola.
What happens atomically to the korban itself?
The korban is all burnt on the Mizbeach. So the translation of ola as the burnt offering is an inaccurate translation. It's an ola.
Mm-hmm. I remember you did the shiur once and you were talking about the significance of the korban and everything and how we can relate to it.
I told you I did this, right? You know.
It was the same week that... what happened in Itamar?
Yeah.
When they were killed, the baby, and I just found it some kind of kesher, but that looks like a korban to Hashem. Like,
fascinating. I said that? Could be. I have to go remember.
That, but that's what happened that week. It was that week.
It was this week. It was. It was. It happened at this time of the year. It was three years ago now.
That they were killed.
Yeah.
Like that was what the korban.
So we'll see you in a second. If it's an ola korbano, so when you bring a min habakar, zahar tamim, if you want to bring from your cattle, it has to be zahar tamim, a pure zahar, male animal. El petach omo yakrivoto, lirtzono, lifnei Hashem. Lirtzono is very difficult to translate. Liratzon. Lirtzono, before, what does liratzon mean?
No, I think liratzon,
of person is of his will. Correct. By the way, a korban ola, these korbanot were offered as nidava, a person gave an oath. These are not compelled korbanot. It's fascinating to note, the original korbanot that are offered, that are described in Vayikra, are all voluntary korbanot.
Lirtzono.
We'll get to later on, if you made a chatat, and if you have an asham. Okay, but the first
this is like if you're just overflowing with gratitude. Absolutely. And feel like you want to give a gift.
You want to give something to God, just because.
Just because.
How do we give something to God? What do you do today? So you give tzedakah, you give whatever.
You give to His creations.
What? You daven. That's not giving to God. It's nice. It's good.
You give tzedakah.
Tzedakah, right? In which you eat. But I don't want, but if I give something to you, somebody else benefits. I want to give something to God.
There's no way.
That's right. There's no way. This is a korban olah. I want to give something to God. Samach yado al rosh ha'olah. This is part of the act. You do what's called smicha. Samach yado. What? No. Samach yado. You put your hands. You lean with all full force. You lean on it. Smicha.
All four corners of your hand.
You do smicha on it. You lean on it. With, you know, it's a physical act. Very strong physical act on the animal.
Someone hold the animal so it doesn't move.
Oh, well, this one is easy because it's bakar. You ever see a bakar? Anybody know how big a bakar? Have you ever seen a...
Or it could be minatzon also.
Right, correct. Somebody would hold it, I'm sure. Male, ram, not the ayo. Bakar is a bull. Huge, wow. Huge animals. Okay. Vinirtsalo, from the root of lirtsono. It should be nirtsa, of will, right? L'chaperalav, as an atonement. Fascinatingly, look at Rashi for a second. What atonement could it possibly be? Interestingly, V'nir Tzalo says Rashi, Almahum Ratzalo, what in the world is this Ola appeasing? What is he bringing appeasement for? Im Tomar Krito to Mitot Beitin, right? Maybe it's something terrible that you did. You did something terrible, you wanted an atonement. O Mita Beshel De Shamayim, O Malkut, Hare On Sham Amor. It's not any of those things.
In other words, it's not instead of getting one of those other punishments.
Right. If you deserve punishment, you get a punishment. Ha'enu meratze ela al asay va'alav shenitach la'asay. What's an asay?
You don't get. There's no punishment for that. Right.
Bitul asay. There's no. The only atonement you can get from these things is, let's say, an example of a bitul asay. You forgot the bench. That's an asay. Ba'chalta v'savata v'rachta. Shake the lulav. Right. Not for that. For you. For me. Right? You didn't do. I didn't put on tefillin one day. Like, and to be honest with you, these are the easiest things to get tshuva for. The Rambam says he wanted. If you forgot to do an asay, right? And you do tshuva. You promise God, do tshuva. He says you get kapar right then and there. So you don't have to bring a korban ola in order to do tshuva for these things. But
you're so wrecked with guilt that
you want to. And this is not a korban chatat, right? That's not, you know. You bring a korban chatat if you violated Shabbat. This is like very minor. So what do you do?
No, you don't have to do anything.
We'll come to it. One second. You bring this before God. You do this tzmicha. Then the next thing you do, obviously, is slaughter the animal. Okay? And what do you have to do then?
Bring the blood.
No, how do you bring the blood?
Collect the blood.
You have to catch the blood. You have to catch it in a bowl. Okay? In a special bowl. Then you have to bring it to the Mizbeach. All these things are done. They have to be done specifically with Kavanah for the proper Korban. Same as when you... It is Shechita. It is Shechita. Regular Shechita. Same as when you...
Hamburgers.
Right. Same as burgers. V'zarku et adam al Mizbeach saviv. They will zarku. No, what's zarku?
Throw.
Splatter. Dam Mizbeach saviv. I share petach Ol Moed in the entrance of Ol Moed.
So,
anybody here go to the Machon Hamikdash? You ever go to the Machon Hamikdash?
Yeah.
You went, you know, and they show you the beautiful pictures of the Beit Hamikdash. Mm-hmm. Right? There's only one thing they don't show you in the picture.
All the blood.
All over the place. I mean, think about it. They
probably drains.
They had drains, and they did clean it clearly. What?
So they didn't smell. There were no flies.
Correct. There was miracles in there. The Gemara says explicitly that it didn't smell. It didn't stink. But you're talking about the world's biggest, busiest slaughterhouse. Also, don't forget, another part of the Avodah in the Beit HaMikdash was the Ketoret.
Cancels
it out. But it overwhelms it. You have this incense, you know, and they're singing. They said it was a very, of course, emotionally moving experience, because you come in and then the Levium are singing these unbelievable choir, and then there's music going on, and there's this smell. It was sensory overwhelming. The smell of the Ketoret, and you're doing this smicha on this animal. It's an overpowering. I just, even thinking about it gives you kind of chills about how overwhelming it was supposed to be, because this is, you're in the Beit HaMikdash. You're not like, you know, in, you know, the Merkezi Shul. You're in the Beit HaMikdash. And you had to go to the mikvah, and you had to wait 7 days and become tahor, and you could only go up to a certain point. Yeah, it was an experience. It was an event to go offer a korban. Wait one second. So what is it? They sprinkle the blood on the Mizbeach Saviv. So Rashi says, it's what's called Notein Shtayim Shein Arba. Two sprinklings, that's four. Because the Mizbeach had four corners, on the tissue box, right? So you sprinkled on two corners and two opposite corners, and that way you hit all four sides of the Mizbeach. Okay, so the blood was sprinkled on the base of the altar. That's what they did. They threw the blood on the Mizbeach. Then, b'ifshit et ha'ula, v'nitach otal dintachea, lafshit.
Skin it.
V'nadnu b'nei Aaron ha'kohen esh al ha'mizbeach. Then you have to put skin on it, right?
Did everyone know how to do this stuff?
Kohanim.
Oh, so the kohen is shechita.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You actually, the only thing a non-kohen could do was the shechita.
Ah.
A Zar could do Shechita. That's the only thing. All the other stuff, only the Kohen could do.
Zar, but he had to know how to do it.
Yeah, sure.
No.
But also, like, a whole lot of people who share cows, it wouldn't be that you've got a korban.
They never, ever, ever shechted a cow. Never, unless you had brought a korban or the cow was dying. Can anybody tell me why? No.
Too big?
It was your milk.
Yeah.
It was your butter. If it was a ram, it was your tractor. Mm-hmm. It's not like, think about today, animals are, they're not associated with everyday life. But back then, it was just, think about how much an animal cost. Its value in terms of being able to cultivate your land. Its value in terms of, I told the story before, I remember there was this Rav, when I was in West Hartford, his name was Rav Luke, Rav Haskell. No. I don't remember his name. It'll come to me. And he wrote a book about his growing up in the shtetl called Pages of My Life. He just wrote about it, like what his life was in the shtetl. And he said that they had a cow. And they were rich in the shtetl because they had a cow. Because every day they had milk to sell and they could drink a little bit of themselves and they had butter. And they, like, cheese, whatever. You got to be nuts to slaughter one of these things, these animals. And if you had a sheep, you had shearings, and you could sell those shearings. These were, and milk it. These were expensive propositions. So don't think about slaughtering your cow. Think about slaughtering your minivan. Right? You know what I'm saying? If Tammy had to offer her minivan, the Beit HaMikdash, that's an offering. If you love God enough to say, I don't need my car, and I'll do without it, and I'm going to offer this thing. You know, that's a huge deal.
You always had an imbalance.
Of course, there were some. Of course, there were some.
Maybe it wasn't.
People for food. Not ever for food. Very, 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 very rare. I believe. You think you had wealthy people who did? Yeah, of course, you always have wealthy people who did. But you're talking about the average korban, the average person. Next person. We'll skip a little bit. So then they would wash it, they would clear it, they would quarter the animal, and then they would offer it. Next, bimin atzon korban oyur, which you could offer from sheep. I'll skip. Then they go into all the details. Same thing.
I mean, that easy. Wait. Our tour guide said there were no goats in Israel.
By the way, I don't have time to talk about the easy. It is a goat. Pasuk yudalet, bim min haof ola korban. You wanted to offer. So let's say.
Chicken.
No.
Bird.
They didn't have chickens.
Pigeons.
Right. Uh-huh. No. Who had chickens? Chickens are totally European creation. By the way, the chickens that we have today are genetically modified. They didn't exist chickens like that. They didn't have chickens like that. They had what? Doves, turtle doves. No. That's like the Bill Bryson book. Somebody has to do a etymology of chickens. I think he did. Turtle doves are pigeons. Game. That people ate all kinds of In the Bryson book, he talks about all kinds of crazy stuff people ate. They would eat anything. They would eat all the birds. We don't eat any of these things. Okay? Okay, and then, what's the last thing you could offer? What? The last guy you could offer, I'm skipping. The last thing you could offer is? Pasuk Aleph, Perek Bet, Pasuk Aleph. Torim or B'nai Yonah, right? Per total doves or pigeons. V'nefesh ki tikriv korban mincha l'Hashem. Korban mincha. Mincha is
a non-animal.
Non-animal. It's a korban of flour, a fine flour, which in of itself was a lot. It was usually
solid as
semolina, fine quality, a fine flour, which is also incredibly expensive. Don't think people didn't have fine flour. They didn't. It was
took a long time to
make. They didn't grind it in the same way. Right? What we call whole wheat is their fine flour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had, you know, like, think about right. It was mixed with
so
chaff.
The exact same
what they say about the dirt, about the bread in the 19? What do you write, Bryson, about the?
No, that they used to add all kinds of things to it. To
why?
Make it white, because otherwise it was very expensive.
Right. So the bread, the bakers to save money, they
would
add dirt.
That's how they had baker's dozen. That's correct. why they came up with baker's dozen to even out.
So if you would want to bring that, okay. Okay. So look at Rashi and Pasuk Aleph. Just to add, look at Rashi and Pasuk Aleph. The nefesh kitakrib. Lo nomar nefesh. Why does it say nefesh ki takriv about korban mincha? What does that mean, nefesh? B'chol korbanot, I'm on Rashi on Bet Aleph. Lo nomar nefesh b'chol korbanot nedavar ela b'mincha. What does it say, nefesh? This a soul, if a soul wants to offer. Mi dar kol yidadei mincha. Who offers a korban mincha? Ani, someone who's poor. Amar kadosh baruch hu, ma'ale ani k'ilu hikriv nafsho. Right, someone who doesn't bring an animal? Okay, you didn't bring the ram, you didn't bring the bull, you couldn't bring the sheep, you couldn't even bring a pigeon. So who brings the flour? The guy who can't afford more. Says, Rashi says, quoting the Midrash, ma'ale ani k'ilu hikriv nafsho. Right, it's the same thing. I don't care, it's a very beautiful idea. I don't care what you bring, as long as you bring what you can bring. I mean, I don't want the rich guy to say, I'll bring a mincha. You know, but if the poor person, if he brings what he can, if all he can bring is korban mincha, and he has this outpouring of love for God, and he wants to offer the korban mincha, he can do that too. So it didn't have to be an animal.
It's the opposite idea of the chatzit hashakal.
Correct. It is. What do you mean? Each person according to his ability.
He only brought a half chatzit hashakal, and that was it, because there wasn't going to be any difference between this one brings more and this one brings less.
Right. I think that the Torah tries to find society is like that. On the one hand, we believe one person, one vote. On the other hand, rich people have more influence. Right, so they try to find a balance between the machzid hashekel went to the kiyum of the Beit HaMikdash, to the upkeep. So everybody had a part. But on the other hand, let's not kid ourselves into thinking that while we might pay our dues, there's some rich guy who gave $1 zillion who the shul is named after. Right, so how do you find a balance? Which is important? The answer is? What? Right, everyone's important. Both are important. You need the masses, but you also need the rich according to his ability and the poor according to his ability.
Korban, that could be a good solution for the future.
What's that? Oh, korban mincha.
Is accepted korban. It's only accepted for mincha.
So are you going to stop eating meat?
Maybe, I don't know.
If we all stop eating meat, so some people suggest in the name of Rav Kook that the world is going to, Rav Kook alludes to this, that the world is going to be vegetarian. Rav Kook doesn't actually say this. Rav Kook says that in the ideal world, if in the times of the redemption,
like if you go back to Gan Eden,
correct. In the times of the redemption, it all depends on how you see the times of redemption. If the times of redemption, like the Rambam says, that world hasn't changed, but we'll just build the Beit HaMikdash, right? Then, of course, we'll have animal sacrifice. But Rav Kook says that in Gan Eden, man was supposed to only benefit not from the eating of animals, meaning Adam HaRishon also didn't eat animals. He was in partnership with nature. So all he ate from was produce. Correct. So if that's your idea of, then if you believe that in the end of days, that the whole nature of man will change. To return to Gan Eden means the essential, the fundamental altering of the nature of human beings. So if that's what you want to say, then it's possible to suggest that we want an animal sacrifice. But if that's not going to happen, or until that takes place, if the redemption and the process of redemption is bringing or the return of the Beit HaMikdash first, without a doubt, we'll certainly have korbanot. And I will prove it to you next week. I have a section here from Ein Ayah. I won't prove it. I'm going to read it because I have a couple more minutes. I have one more minute. We started a bit late. 1 second. The cook says the following in Ein Ayah. The cook says, Okay. He says. Okay. He's talking about, I'm in the middle of a long section, he's talking about one of the shortcomings of the world without the Beit HaMikdash. Mitzad avodat korbanot. Right? From the side of avodat korbanot, shemizeh nimshach shleimut gdola beolam. Right? There's a shleimut, a completion in the world, v'shefa rav. And great shefa. Shefa means? What? Abundance, divine abundance. Through the offering of the korbanot, great abundance comes to the world. V'rotzono yitbarach lehitiv lebriyotav. God wants to bring goodness to the world. V'kol zeh shechaser hadavar hamashlim. Without the idea, the thing that brings the shleimut, ein hanhaga b'shleimotav. Okay? The hanhaga, this leadership, this functioning of the world is not shalem. Without the Beit HaMikdash, Rav Kook clearly believed, without the korbanot, without the functioning of the Beit HaMikdash, the world isn't functioning in its proper way. It's almost as if to say, you know, try to run a house, try to run anything without its central functioning. It's working, there's all kinds of workarounds, but you're bypassing the central engine, the spiritual engine of the world. This, clearly, many, many, many of Chazal, many, many, many of our, you know, religious guides throughout history believed, was fundamental to the functioning of the world. So if we can't appreciate it and can't understand it, a lot of things we don't appreciate and don't understand. And our goal is to say, Kadosh Baruch Hu created the world. He knew our own nature. He knew how the world was supposed to function. Today we live in a world of reason, and if I can't understand it, and I can't appreciate it, and it's not something that I can readily accept and see, then it must not be true. And it must not be effective, and it must not have any use. And we don't believe that. We believe that the creator of the world gave us the mitzvot in order for us to function as humanity and as Jews in the best possible way. And if we have trouble with korbanot, then our responsibility and our obligation is to try to, A, try to reconcile ourselves with that, and B, come to the understanding and the belief that the shortcoming is in our appreciation of God's understanding of the world, and not chas v'shalom the other way around. Stop here.